Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Cambone Omoyani. Cambone Omoyani is the author of several books, including Argos and Aphorisms, Blue Moon Murmurs. Cambone Omoyani is also the owner of Jazz Maya Productions and Publications. He is living and residing in Tucson, Arizona. How are you doing today?
All right, man. How you doing?
Okay, your wife hooked you up.
Yeah,
that's why. You know, we want to make sure everything's working. That's why we try to get you on the air early.
Well, it's interesting. The women in our lives, especially for artists, they always put us in order. You know.
All right. Okay. Okay. You know, I wanted to begin. I mean, you're extremely prolific. But I want to first discuss your book, Argos and Aphorisms. And I was just wondering, is there a special way you want a person to read and use this book?
I think it's probably situational, because the inspiration for each of them comes from situations in which I observed, or which, you know, you pass through life and you see something. So therefore, when something passes in someone's life, when something occurs, I would hope that they would pick up the book and just turn to a page and look at something and say, wow, okay, here's a thought that I can refer to as I deal with this situation.
See, I was wondering as I was reading this, I said, I wonder if Cambone, I'm like, you know, he's getting in trouble, and these are things that his mother or father or great aunt said to him.
I had an uncle. Two uncles, actually, one who was a jeweler and one who was a painter. And they gave me a lot of aphorisms, a lot of wisdoms, but they were different kind of cats. You know, they were 8-to-5 cats who worked and came home and then did their art when they could. So the things that I would think that when I was like around Michael Harper and Sterling A. Brown, all these people we were talking about before, there was all these, I used to call them ditties, which you'd constantly be throwing at you as you'd be walking. They'd be saying things that coming out. My uncles and them weren't like that. So everything that weren't like that. So what happened is that I began to rely on myself and things that I had experienced in all the, you know, those 14 years I was abroad and never coming back for a couple.
Well, you know, when you mentioned Sterling Brown, sometimes he was saying some things in between the poems. He said they were lies. You know? So why don't you share a few lies with us this morning? I sent you a couple, and I wanted you first read with the one on page 12.
Okay. On page 12, here we go. There's my marker. The way you treat a man or a woman reflects on how you feel about your mother, father.
Okay, now you open up the program and you mentioned about your wife helping you, okay? Now, okay, look at your wife and look at your mother. Is there a connection?
The spirit. Between the spirit. My mom is, she's 96 now. My mom is very spirited. And my wife is spirit. But there's also something which I realized just the other day. My brothers used to talk about my mom riding the broom because she was insightful. And my great-grandmother was a hoodoo woman, a voodoo woman. So that kind of spiritual...
Riding the broom. Explain that to me. Riding the broom. I'm from the South Bronx. Riding the broom. translate that into Spanish for me.
Riding the broom is when all those insights be coming from your mom, and she be seeing around corners and seeing into things that you're doing. Her perception of the world is such that she just... the clarification is there. So when she's riding the broom, she's moving through the world on that broom, which is provides her with insights, you know, and information that she can pass on. And sometimes you get busted because she's riding the broom, you know.
We're riding the broom, man. It is October, and I'm thinking Halloween just came early.
Well, for you as a Southerner, what would riding the broom mean? It doesn't have any significance.
I'm not a Southerner. That's why I said I'm from the South Bronx, but that ain't the South.
Oh, I thought you were from the Up South.
You're talking about John Killings, like.
You're not a Washingtonian. Okay.
No, I'm not a Washingtonian, brother.
Are you from the Bronx?
I'm from the Bronx.
Okay.
And then my father was born in Panama.
Panamanians.
Yeah, so that's a connection there. Well, let's get back to you, man.
Okay.
You have another bit of wisdom on page 20.
Okay. Yeah, page 20. But also, you know, you see your mother and the people that you're with, or your father, the people with, and one's frame of reference is always from those first 5 years when you grew up with them. So, you know, they're the things that, you know, the way you treat them, it definitely reflects on who they are, because that's who you knew first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's so. This one says, removing her heart from her chest, she served it to him on a platter. And when he sliced a piece and added spices, she opened her door and asked him to leave.
Explain that one.
To offer, when people give, you know, mm-hmm. they give freely and they give openly in who they are. And many times when someone wants to change that person, yeah, by adding something, oh, you'd be better this way. It's right. Discordant.
Right.
Yeah, you don't want that in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember, you know, we're of the same generation. I had a sister who said to me, she said, a woman can read a man within 3 minutes for our generation, baby boomers. For a generation next, was my daughter, who's 50 now, they said, we read men in 30 seconds.
And now today it's just pure telepathy.
So if he comes off in a certain way, which is not consistent, doesn't help with their person, with what she's about or he's about, it's not going to work. So it's better to stop it right there. Yes?
Okay, well, let's read one last one. Okay. Because what you just said, I want you to lead into what's on page 50.
Okay. It says, on the second date, she mentioned she needed money. There was no third.
That sounds like that's something that happened to you.
You know, Ethelbert, man, for our generation, we benefited from the Greatest Society plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got jobs. We are the ones who really benefited. But some people let the materialism get the best.
Right.
And they're from that old time philosophy, well, what a man's supposed to do for a woman. Mm-hmm. And what are you supposed to give her money?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, some people didn't cater to that philosophy. No, if we've met twice and already you're asking me for money, that means that what you're interested in is not me.
Right.
It's the financial aspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, talking about financial aspect, you have been able to run, you know, Jazz Meyer Productions and publications.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk about that skill that you had in terms of putting together an organization to put out your work.
Okay, we have Jazz Meyer Productions Publications. The name of it comes from my granddaughter, Jasmine, and my daughter, whose name is Ayana. So that's where Jazz Meyer comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Doubleday under Marie Brown.
Oh, yeah. She's like the godmother of the literary agents.
But she was a literary, she was an editor at that
right time. Doubleday. Yeah,
and I was studying under her. She mm-hmm. gave me projects. There's a book out called 400 Years of African American Art with all these artists, Charles Johnson.
Right. I remember Roman that book. Yeah.
All those. Well, I edited that.
Yeah, with Clarence Majors in there, I think.
Yes, all of them. Right. Learned the how to edit, how to organize from watching Marie Brown and looking at what was going on at Doubleday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I noticed that at Doubleday, you know, Ethelbert, nothing started until 10 o'clock, but people worked from 10 o'clock to 8.
Mm-hmm.
Disciplinedly and religiously, and they stayed on it. When one was conferred, there was always conference going on with mm-hmm. projects so that everybody was in the loop. So basically, in terms of organizing Jazz Meyer, what I did was that I got some reliable people who would work with me, and we set up this organization so that mm-hmm. we took care of covers, we take care of editing, all of that. and it's based on that model, mm-hmm. you know, basically. And then, but I found something else. There was a magazine called Flash Magazine coming out of L.A., which was, and Langston Hughes helped the people, and the poets and writers in L.A. put it together. Mm. They had a whole different structure. So as Jazzmire developed, I kept looking at what they were doing, and I thought, wow, yeah, look at the organization between pictures and word, between all, it was there. And that really took me, it got us over the hump.
Well, you also collaborated with a friend of yours, Walter Williams. Talk about your relationship with him. He's, because he's your illustrator.
Yeah, Slim. He's worked for the Department of Medicine. I can't remember what it is. And Slim is an artist, a medical doctor during the day, DOD, not DOD, DO something. He works as a medical doctor during the day and is an artist at night. Mm-hmm. And we've known each other since 1974. As a matter of fact, we were hungry and we shared a loaf of bread together, mm-hmm. as undergraduates. So Dr. Williams is a guy who has an interesting perception. He's always tuned in, you know, always tuned in. The way that I used to, when I was around Baraka, and you knew him better than I. Mm-hmm. When I was Baraka, I was watching him, and it looked like he was taking in everything that was going in the room, but he wasn't moving. His head, it was, you know, he was taking in everything, you know? And then he started kind of moving his mouth. He took out a little piece of paper, and started scribbling on it. And when I walked towards him, he took it and put it in his pocket and leaned back and just gave me this look. you know what I mean? So Slim has that kind of perception. Not on the level as Baraka, but that's kind of
right.
Cat he is.
Well, let's go back. You know, I'm glad you mentioned Marie Brown, because the scholar Dana Williams at Howard University just produced this book, Tony at Random, looking at Toni Morrison as an editor. You know, we think of her as a novelist, winner of the Nobel Prize, but, you know, she's mm-hmm. an editor at a long time. And I remember, I mean, when you think about Marie Brown, Doubleday, and then Toni Morrison at Random House, a lot of books, you know, we have to be grateful for. I mean, when you mentioned Marie Brown, Marie Brown called me up and asked if I wanted to do this anthology, which became In Search of Color Everywhere.
Wow.
But that started out as a Marie Brown book, because she was talking to Stuart Tabor and Chang at that time. Mm. But, you know, I've wondered, in terms of Marie Brown, as you say, working with her, what drove her to say, I'm going to give up this position as an editor and get into become an agent?
She loves writers.
Okay.
And she believes in the word. And some, in their own way, I used to, would call her a literary nationalist, mm-hmm. because she is very much grounded in the tradition and believes in it. And something interesting, she comes out of those black schools. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, that's the same thing with Toni Morrison, because, you know, when you look at the book that she was doing early, with like Huey Newton, Stokely Speaks, you know. Back.
Yeah. Man, Child in the Promised Land.
Let me ask you a key question now. You in there? What about, you know, we go back, we see this sort of like racism within the publishing industry. Did you witness that?
Very much so. Very much. So the word I heard in those dormitory the offices they would drop was like, oh, it's one of those books. mm-hmm. You know, and it would infuriate me. Yes. Because it was very subtle, but that would be the word. Also, when I was first starting out, and I was in New York in 1977, one gentleman said to me, we love your book, but we don't publish a lot of black books, and, you know, we don't have the facility to market it. We wouldn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, when you talk about the marketing, and I also want you to talk about your company and how you mm-hmm. handle the marketing and distribution. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things about the marketing was, you know, people are saying, okay, black people don't buy books. But then we also see at the time that you were at the Doubleday, the rise of black studies and the rise of black bookstores.
Yes. nationally, everywhere, and internationally. And it was important. And Tone, Miss Morrison and Marie Brown, they were very much the trailblazers for that. Yes, because they put out black books and they knew how to market them. And that, people who said black people don't buy books, is like black people don't support jazz. It's a damn lie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On a line right now, what's that? The AA, the African American Association of Book Dealers or something like that. There's a circuit to it. They will connect you to every bookstore in the United States that sells African-American, African-centered books.
Mm-hmm.
And, they stay in business because black people are out there buying books, especially the baby boomers.
Right.
Yeah. We came of age on Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the book that you've, you have a variety of books, textbooks, things like that. When you look at, let's say, the books that we're talking about today, the Argos and Aphorism, who's your target audience? When somebody says, okay, this company is producing books, I'm thinking of some company like Lee & Loh, who's doing children's books. Mm-hmm. You have so many different types of books. Who mm-hmm. would you say is your target audience? And you're in that, and you're in Tucson, Arizona.
I'm tired of Tucson, Arizona. I'm an LA cat. I'm from West
Lower, what they call Lower Alabama, right?
Yeah. Very much so. With Sugar Hill, too, there. Right. Our target audience, I would have to say, the reading public, nationally and internationally, because we have a series on Tales from Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have books by Abdullahi from the Sudan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, called The Merchant we have writers, religious writers. We have pimps and people from the street. So we have a reading public. We have translations from Spanish. Right. And into Spanish. We're in the reading market.
Well, talking about reading market, I want you to read and prepare our listeners. It's not that long, but I found that this story that you have in Blue Moon Murmurs vignettes, I thought it was very interesting. One is, this is about the Hmong people who, I was just wondering, I know you've done a lot of traveling. Mm-hmm. And so this, I said, you must have been in Vietnam. I think if you're talking about Hmong because of their history. And I know many of them reside today in the United States. They reside in Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Right. So talk about this short vignette of shame, and then share it with our listeners.
My brother did four tours of Vietnam, and I was at one time I was married to an Aboriginal woman from Taiwan, and the Hmong and the Taiwanese Aboriginals are cousins. They speak the same language, even though one is in Vietnam. And one is in Taiwan, in China, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I lived with the Taiyachu in Taiwan, and we have a daughter, and I observed what was going on when I came back to the States in 1990. What was going on with the Afro-Asian communities,
right?
Yeah, and parenting and what was going on. And what I was observing was that those children were living some double, sometimes triple lives.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them were ashamed of their dads.
Especially those who were in, say, grew up in Vietnam.
Grew up in Vietnam.
So not necessarily the U.S., but,
But when they came here,
mm-hmm.
what they learned... And this is from children who are going to Fairfax. And this, what they learned was that being Asian was an advantage because the Anglo community considered them as close with them. Mm-hmm. But having the African-American father was problematic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear this story, Shane.
I'm a murderer. I'm 16 and I'm a murderer. I'm a murderer and I killed the one who really loved me. I'm a murderer and even my friend Tori, she's Korean, knows it. She's sitting across the room looking at me with her hands like a shovel, trying to scoop up her tears and pour them into her bucket of hurt between her knees. I was Tori's best friend, and she was mine, but now I don't know because she knows I killed him. My sister is sitting next to Tori, and she won't look at me or come near me. I feel the knot on my head where my sister hit me yesterday when she came into the house. My mom, our mom, pulled her off me. I wanted her to keep hitting me, though, because I'm a murderer, and she knows I killed him. Everyone knows I killed him, and I'm sitting here alone now as a murderer at 16 and looking at him. He's in a casket, and he's my father. He's my father, and I killed him. I killed him. I killed him. I killed him. I walked in alone before everyone arrived and looked at him. I hate the powder they put on his face. I hate it because he'd hate it. He didn't use the word hate, but I knew he wouldn't like it. He didn't like it when he was on TV for his book, excuse me, and they wanted to put makeup on him. He refused and his face shined on TV. He was like that, always shining and working for us. My mom, my sister, and me. I'm 16 and my sister's 24. She was born in 1971 during the Vietnam War. My dad was a soldier and I was born in 1979 after the war. We were both born in Laos and we're Hmong, or they're Hmong, and I don't know what I am, but people say I'm Chinese because we all speak it and let them, though I know it's not true. I'm Hmong. They call me whatever they want as long as they let me be. They can call me, excuse me. I'm not like my sister. I'm not like her because she tells everyone she's black and Hmong. She says that because it's true for her, but not for me because of my father. The man whose sperm I have isn't black. He's Hmong, but I don't even know him. I only know my dad stiff in the casket dead, and I killed him. He came back from America after 9 years and got my mom, my sister, and me. Before that, he came back. He came every year before I was born and after I was born. And finally, when I was 11, he brought us to the U.S. That's when it started. That's when the look started. And when he'd come to school to pick me up or for teachers' conferences, people would look and whisper. My Asian friends would look and whisper. They smile when it was me and my mommy, but not when he came. If he'd speak to me in Hmong or Chinese, we were somewhere, I'd pretend I didn't understand, so he'd repeat it in English. People liked me because I was Asian, but didn't like me if I was with him. I asked mommy to only come to events and conferences. And when she told him, I watched his shoulders sag, but he stopped coming for me. He gave me everything I wanted and was always there for me. He listened to me and gave me all his knowledge. He was a professor and almost famous, but that didn't stop the looks and comments, so I wouldn't go with my mommy and sister to places where they honored him, and he knew it. That's why I killed him. I didn't want to, but I had to kill him. I had to do it. He came to pick me up from the mall because mommy was sick and I was with my Asian friends. He stood waiting for me, and when they saw him, they stopped talking. I said he was my stepfather loud, and their silence cut my heart. He waited for me, and when I went to him, he put his arm around me, and I pulled away from him. I pulled away from him, and I moved away from him, and he made a sound like a hurt animal, but let me walk in front of him like I wasn't with him. His body slumped when I got in the back seat of the car instead of the front seat because my friends could see us, and his chin trembled as he drove. My friend Tori saw it all and waved to him. He waved back. He helped Tori and her family get their papers and let them live in one of our apartments a year for free and helped her mother and father get a job at the university where he taught. Tori loved him. Now she hates me. And I can see it in her eyes. her mother was with my dad when it happened, when I killed him. He went to his office at the university after taking me home and waiting until I went inside our big house, then fell dead in his office. His heart broke and I broke it. I broke it and killed him. And that's why I'm a murderer. Oh, Daddy, I'm so, so sorry.
You're listening to Campbell Obiani reading his story, Shame, from this book, Blue Moon Murmurs. Thank you for that reading, Campbell. Anything you want to add to this? You know, when is, how many years ago was this written?
I wrote Ethelbert. Sometimes you know how it is.
Right.
The consummate writer you are.
Well, let me ask you about one book. We want you to talk about this book, and mm-hmm. then you know we have a little break. One book which I thought this is completely different in style that you wrote, actually 11 years ago, mm-hmm. is Island of Song.
Yes.
Just talk about that. I mean, you sort of hinted at, you know, your travels and stuff. And it seems to be outgrowth of this. But talk about this, because I felt the writing in this was completely different from the ones that you had been, the other, like Blue Moon Murmurs and stuff. Like, it's like a completely different style.
The style came out of the voices and the songs of the Taiyachu in China. Ethelbert Mann. The Native American experience in the United States is duplicated in Taiwan. And the United States assisted the Chinese, not the mainland Chinese, but the Taiwanese, in subduing and putting the Native Americans on reservations. But they have a vibe about them, and that is so energetically peaceful that when you're there, first of all, the reservation where they live is above the treetops and at the top of the mountains. So when you look out, you are looking at the tops of trees and the sky, and it's like you can reach out and grab a cloud and pull it down and put it in your pocket. And they have these songs that they sing and this humming that's going on 24/7. And I never found out in 5 years where it was coming from. And when I asked them about it, nobody would say anything. Finally, I met an elder guy. He was just walking along and he transitioned the next day. Had big, long hoops in his ears. Tattoos up the from his nose to his top of his head, down his chin and under both eyes and down. And he was walking alone. And I prostrated before him and I said, Baba, what is the source of the sound? And he put his hand to his heart and he said, it's here, and it's coming through all of us.
Well, you know, that's a good place for us to take a little break.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's coming through all of us. I'm listening to my guest, Campbell Obiani, and he is sharing his work today.
Can I say something before?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
My admiration for you is unfathomable. You are one of the baddest mofos in the mofo world, Negro.
Okay, now we're gonna go to a station break. Okay, on that note, the show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of December 8th, 2025. On December 11th from 5 to 7 p.m., BC Trainers Network will hold an end-of-year celebration at the Festival Center on 1640 Columbia Road Northwest to enjoy food and a wonderful celebration of all the activists that have been trained to facilitate better meetings, anti-racist practices, and more. For more info, visit dctrainersnetwork.com. Thursday, December 11th, the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, invites you to the COP30 Virtual Report Back, the world's people versus the global polluters, what happened at the UN Climate Summit in Brazil, with a panel of movement organizers who were on the ground in Belém to speak about the road ahead for the fight for climate justice, 4 to 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. More info and registration is on ips-dc.org/events. WVFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Kambono Wayani, and he is a writer living in Tucson, Arizona, also a publisher in terms of his company, Josh Meyer Productions and Publications. I want to take you back, Kambono, to something we were talking about. You mentioned you went to Brown University.
Yes.
I want you to talk about two people, one your professor and then one of your colleagues, and that is talk about Michael Harper and Gail Jones. And talk about Michael Harper first, but in terms of his importance to you personally as a teacher, and how did he instruct you? When I think of Michael Harper, I think if anybody comes to him, is going to get a heavy dose of Sterling Brown and Melvin Tolson.
Yes. Yes. Michael encouraged my literacism because I worked very hard on that. And if you see the other books, and it comes out in Bird Island of Song, comes out in their most. I loved Jean Tumor, Jean Tumor, if you wish. And I could hear that. And Michael was not a professor who instructed. He said nothing to you. And when there was a final product, he would say something, but all the time you were writing, he said nothing. He was a tough cat, man. A lot of
he was a big guy too.
Yeah, a lot of people said he was a bully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't like that. He was just a tough cat, and his dad was. He grew up. You know, he had to be tough. He was a big dude,
mm-hmm.
And as he said, and I was a big yellow nigga, and everybody wanted to try me, so I had to show him that this big yellow nigga wasn't afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Because yellow niggas were considered weak when he was coming along.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that toughness about him. And but he loved lyricism. He loved Melvin B. Tolson, and he worshiped Sterling A. Brown. And he brought them. Mr. Tolson wasn't alive. Mr. Brown was there. And Michael, the look in his eyes. And I thought Sterling A. Brown walked on water, you know, because the way he moved and his jokes and what have you. So that was Michael. Gail was a silent friend who does not speak, afraid of elevators and going up escalators, and speaks seven languages, reads 11 languages, and believes in silence and in working and getting inside the character. Michael Harper used to say something to both of us. He used to say, "You all, and remember this." And he said, and I learned this from Sterling Brown. And we were on the edge of our chair. And he said, chairs. He said, "Write with the intent to evoke."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, write with the intent to evoke. And so that when you write, the words and everything rises off the page.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a song there, the reader can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can hear the musicality. They can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gail, you know, that's what she does. And she's such a vivid and avid reader.
Talk about her interest in Brazil, with Brazil.
Well, she cursed me out for not being in touch with her when I lived in Brazil. She was so angry with me because she feels as if Brazil is the heart of Africanisms. Mm. She says it all comes together in Brazil for all of us around the world through the diaspora. Mm. And that if you dig into the roots of Brazil, you're going to find everything that we all do, and it's all there. And all you have to do is get past the language, and we got it. And that was happened. Also, because of what happened in Brazil, you know, with the Colombos, which are maroon societies, they built a whole nother world that coexisted in Brazil along with the Portuguese world, so that you've got the Catholicism, like in religion. And they also have Umbanda in Portuguese, or Nago, which means down there, because the Africans would say, where's our religion? And they would say, down there. Mm-hmm. Right? Babe, I need a plug. They would say down there. So that's how it developed. So you have the Catholicism, which is the Western, and the African right there. Yes? And you have both elements. And then you got the Native Americans who look like us, but have different cultural rhythms and the poetry and the sound of it. The Native Americans sing through their nose in their poetry. Etheridge, man. Mm. It sounds like, you know, them cats from down the some of the blues singers, how they sing through their nose. You know that? You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
That's what it sounds like.
I'm trying to write through my nose, if you understand what I'm saying.
I hear you. I hear you.
Let me ask you a question about this, because we're probably talking about, you know, Gayle Jones, and there is a complexity. I felt that her work changed with the book Mosquito.
Yes.
You know, it just completely, the depth and the texture just got richer. Corregidor and Evers Man was sort of like vignettes, when you say. It just seems like she really reached her stride with that book, Mosquito.
She found her home. Mm. She found her home, and she really found her voice. Evers Man, you know, with the guy, he had the stroke and one foot was turning out the master, and he was evil. All those elements that she brought in from the States, those... I stopped because I've always been searching for this world, for this word. When we deal with the other elements of reality in our world, which are not physical, what is it? What's the word for that, Etheridge, man?
I mean, Ethelbert. Yeah, you commune with Etheridge now.
Ethelbert. I'm sorry, Ethelbert. What is the adjective for that? What is the nomenclature?
What it is? Because this is not a call-in. Right now, I'm certain that somebody knows the word that you're trying to find.
Yeah, it's like when you look at it when reading Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Right. The magical realism thing.
They say magical, but it's something else for us. That's what Gayle found. Mm-hmm. She found that something else in her work changed. When she did the healing, I was surprised. I thought, what are you coming back to this for? Where's this? But she told me that manuscript had been sitting in there for 17 years.
You know, let me ask you, could you make a connection? I'm thinking another woman. When you talk about healing, things of that sort, I'm thinking of Tony Capon Barra. I'm thinking about the Salt Eaters book like that, where she's dealing with the environment. She's dealing with everything. And then somebody could also say you could bring Toni Morrison back into that.
Very much so with the Thulies, the twins. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Suva, right? They were around each other so much that they started looking alike.
Right.
You know, and what she say, boy, 73 is something. I was trying to think of the guy who tried to, she said, he tried to climb back in my womb. His mother had cut off one leg in Suva, right? But he tried to climb back in her womb, so she burned him and set him off.
Right, fire, right.
Right?
The cleansing.
Yeah. So go ahead. I lost your question.
I'm just looking at, I want to make a connection between, you know, the right, you know, coming back to you in terms of Brown University and Michael Harper and others, that when we talk about writers, should we direct writers towards understanding more about their folklore, more about, you know, their music, as opposed to sometimes you're just in a workshop and you say, I just want to be a writer, I'm just writing, but you're not plugged into the source. Like when you talk about Gayle Jones seeing Brazil as a certain way, you know, that seems that you reach that point at a certain point in your career as a writer, oh, I know Brazil is this. Or the fact that you say she speaks, what, like X number of languages, mm-hmm. you know, where somebody would say the future of black writers is to be able to speak Portuguese and Spanish and English. I mean, all these things, because the diaspora is that huge.
The diaspora, I speak Spanish and Portuguese and all those languages too. The diaspora knows more about us than we know about them. Mm-hmm. They're reading us. Mm-hmm. They love us the way they love, you know, jazz, funk, hip hop, blues, soul, gospel. Yeah,
that's a good lead into a book you were sending me all these books, and then you said, "Can I send you the book about Junior Walker?" I said, "Man, I got enough books, but let's move in to Junior Walker and music." I mean, this is WPFW, you know, this is a jazz station. But talk about you have you know, we talk about Junior Walker, who died in 1995, and you know, mm-hmm. songs like Shotgun and What Does It Take to Win Your Love. Talk about you, how you got interested in terms of Junior Walker.
My brother, who was an actor, Rafael Juan Noble, he ran across Junior Walker's son, one of his sons, and he said he couldn't find anybody to write the book because he couldn't find anybody who had the sensibilities, to use his word. He said musical sensibilities. And my brother said, "My brother." And so I met with Derek, and I met with the Junior Walker's son, and he was very, very, very cautious and very suspicious mm-hmm. because the family and what had happened and everything. So I play saxophone also. And so when we started talking about music and everything, and I said to him, "How was Junior in the studio?" And he looked at me, he said, "Yo, man, nobody's ever asked that. You got the gig." Mm-hmm. And that's how it started. It was the most gratifyingly frustrating experience I've ever had in my life. Okay. He was Junior was a very, very deep man, very complex individual. Very, very complex. And studying him, researching and talking to people, I've never encountered anyone that people talked about in that way. At one time, they said he could be the kindest and give his complete salary for a night to somebody who he saw hurting. And the next instance, walk around the corner and he take a tire iron and hit somebody in the head. Mm. Within minutes of each other. That, and you know, and play the horn and scream and everything and go out and go home at night and sleep for 12 hours after a gig. Just all kinds of things, taking out his teeth to get a certain sound on the horn. What kind of fool does that? You know, so that's how I got, and it was a wonderful experience in learning him. It was frustrating that, you know, when you're dealing with the music business, which is a very ugly business, it brings out some qualities in people and amongst families, which is not always.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, you were talking earlier about Doubleday and your time there, and I asked you about what you saw. Looking at the music world and looking at the literary world, what are some of the things of caution that you would tell a young person to look out for?
Take classes, take business classes, and learn how to read contracts. And learn how some math so that you can know when to get your royalties. And the first thing to insist on and to look out for is anybody who does not want to give you your masters, you better be careful, because they're trying to control you. Hmm. You know, and it's interesting, not to get political or to be these conspiracy theories. It's interesting that all of our this generation behind us, which came along, as soon as they start asking for their masters, they all end up dead. All of them. It's, you know, but I want to jump back to something.
Okay. Okay.
You mentioned Tony Capenbrower. Tony was the love of my life. Mm-hmm. Right. And we wrote letters in her books, and Linda Holmes.
Yeah. She Linda was one of her students and then also a biographer.
Right. And so Linda and I, we talked a lot, but Tony, could love to play piano, but could not play any play. She was a terrible piano player, but she loved to play. But she heard music, the musicality, the spirituality. She was with a, Tony was with a group of sisters who were levitating Ethelbert, man. They were levitating and dropping. So, and Tony believed in signs and symbols and that, and this comes back to young people. Tony believed that if we looked into the folklore of Americanisms, Afro-Americanisms, we can never go wrong because everything we needed is right there.
Let me ask you, let me throw out another name, whether you cross paths with her, and that's Verda Mae Grosvenor.
Very much so.
Talk about her.
I forget who it was, some writer, a French Senegalese writer, I don't know who he was, said, the thing with you African Americans is that you don't have any cuisine. And if you looked at him and said, "In, have you never read Verda Mae Grosvenor?" And the, you know, the French writer, he didn't even know who she was. You know, Verda was the folklorist.
Well, you know what I was impressed by. You know, I had a resume, and two things. I will always be grateful for Verda Mae. One, when she was at NPR, she pulled me into her office, and that was the first time I heard she had gotten all these tapes from the Library of Congress of Zora Neale Hurston speaking.
Yes, yes.
So I was always grateful. But then the thing I always was impressed by on her resume, you know, it said Sun Goddess, because she was one of the women with Sun Ra. You know, Sun Ra would have to. Yeah.
So
she
very was, much so.
Yeah.
Very
so much. She was the Sun Goddess.
Yeah. Ed Brown at the same time was George Houston Bass, who was the personal secretary of Langston Hughes the last 7 years of his life, right? Who put it to stink when Harvard got Langston Hughes papers instead of Emory or one of those. It was George Houston Bass who put it in laws, right? George was there. Brother I was there.
Brother I was there, right?
All these people were there at the same time. Brother I and Verda Mae were in Sunrise Band at the same time, right? And Verda, Sunrise gave something, but Verda threw up her hands and sparks flew out of them. But also Tuesday, Thursday, and every other Sunday, which is the book on maids. On black maids, right? You get Tuesday off, Thursday off, and every other Sunday. And so all that came from Verda Mae. So that's what Verda was about. She was about that, you know.
Vibration cooking.
Vibration cooking. Yeah, the travels of a Geechee girl, right? You know, when Verda went to Paris, interesting enough, she told me, I said, how did you make it in Paris? You didn't speak French. She said, I was walking by this club, and she said, there was this blues cat who was from the States, and he was arguing with the French owner about his money. And so she said, I can make out how much the French cat was making. And she said, shoot, I wanted that money. She said, the brother walked out with his guitar. I walked in and took the microphone and started singing. She said, and I got hired for a gig.
Sounds like a Josephine Baker story.
But, you know, we was, you know, Josephine Baker, when Hemingway and all those cats were there, Langston Hughes and all those cats were there at the same time. You know what I mean? Ethelbert,
right,
man.
Right.
So that's with Verda, you know.
Well, let me, as we come to the end of our show, you know, you've been a person of, let's say, a long journey.
Yeah.
You know, and talk about some of the places we didn't get a chance to talk. I mean, we talked about Vietnam. Is there any place key that you visited? You say, okay, this place really influenced me as a writer. I might want to go back there and maybe write about the people, the landscape.
Brazil. Hands down. Brazil. You go from the north, Bahia, Pernambuco, and all that, where everybody's black. Yeah, and they look like us, and Ethelbert, they act like us. That's the funny thing. So they speak Portuguese.
Right.
And then you go to the center to Noel in Portuguese, which is Rio, and you got everything there, and then you hit the south, and it looks like you're in Germany or Italy. Mm-hmm. And you've got all these in that spiritual element and the candomblé and the umbanda and all of that, the music and the literature, you know. I know you know, because we talked about it. You probably don't even remember this. I mentioned Jorge Amado, Jorge Amado. This was like 30 years ago, and you perked up. And I didn't know of anybody other than myself who knew about Jorge Amado.
Well, let me ask you this question, because you're out in, you're out in Tucson. Just to ask you, why Tucson? I mean, is it the landscape there? Is it indigenous people? What gives you a sense of a place and home in Tucson?
I have family here. I retired from the university and the college. It was retirement friendly. Since we have been here, my wife being a healer and a spiritualist and what have you, she has connected all of this element that's here in Arizona that I didn't know about. You know, talking about the women in your life, I have one who is par excellence, and I wouldn't be alive if it were not for her. Literally, I'd be dead. But anyway, those elements are here. I haven't tapped into them. I have not really tapped into the element, the literary elements in Tucson, because it's of a particular brothers are kind of not brothers have a interesting position with this community here that's not very welcoming sometimes. I don't want to go into detail, but you know what I mean.
Sure. Yeah. Are you? This is my last question. Actually, are you affected by environmental change? I know when I look at I used to be out in Las Vegas for a time, but when I look at these temperatures in Phoenix and places like that, it just seems that it's extremely high now.
105 in Tucson, 115 in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. You don't go outside.
Yeah.
If you do, you go out and come back real quick.
So you're out there working on your colors, what you're trying to tell me.
Yeah, I'm working on my colors. Thank you, brother. That's
okay.
I'm working on my
colors. All right.
My colors, which is sound. Thank you, Ethelbert.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Kambono Obiani, for being my guest. Kambono Obiani is living, as we mentioned, in Tucson, Arizona. We've been sharing his work from Argos and Aphorism and also Blue Moon Mirrors. And he is the founder and producer of Jazz Maya Productions and Publication. So, the show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is Medea Benjamin of Code Pink with the WPFW editorial. As Washington escalates towards confrontation with Venezuela, opinion polls show that in the United States and Venezuela, the majority oppose U.S. intervention. Yet instead of listening to the people, the Trump administration is charging ahead with escalation, labeling Venezuelan officials as terrorists, asserting the right to strike vessels in the Caribbean without evidence or congressional approval, tightening sanctions. This week, President Trump said something important, that he is willing to talk to President Nicolas Maduro. We hope so, but let's not be naive. The U.S. has used talks before as a cover for military action, including against Iran, engaging diplomatically one day while preparing strikes the next. So we have to ask, is this a sincere step towards peace or the prelude to something far more dangerous? The fundamental truth is that Venezuela is not our enemy, and war is not the answer. 28 million Venezuelans have already endured years of economic warfare through sanctions that block medicine, fuel, and basic goods. A U.S. military strike would only ignite an internal conflict and shatter countless lives. We've seen this story before: Iraq, Libya, Syria. So today, Code Pink calls on the White House to honor the will of the people and calls on Congress to rein in unauthorized military force and lift sanctions so Venezuelans can rebuild their own country in peace. For WPFW, I'm Medea Benjamin with Code Pink. You can learn more at codepink.org/Latin America.
The WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a community town hall on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. Our theme is Free Airwaves, Fighting for Community and Public Radio. With the economic upheaval caused by DOGE, the social stress exacerbated by the military occupation of the Capitol, and the harm inflicted on innocent people by ICE agents, it is more important than ever to have an independent grassroots media focused on building communities, amplifying marginalized voices, and driving social movements. The town hall takes place on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. at the Brookland Busboys and Poets, 625 Monroe Street, Northeast in the district. Additional information can be found online at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building community one broadcast at a time.
Mutual aid, the act of taking care of each other, comes in many forms. One such form is supporting WPFW. At a time when so many are hurting, if you are doing well financially and want to do good, we invite you to give the gift of WPFW. Emancipatory media is truly the gift that keeps on giving. A tax-deductible donation can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org or from Sunday, December 14th through Saturday, December 20th during our pledge drive by calling 800-222-9739. It is your continued support that allows us to do the work of building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
This season, Joy is taking over Anacostia. From December 11th through the 22nd, Anacostia is celebrating 12 Days of Joy along Marion Barry and MLK Jr. Avenue Southeast. Festive, free events and experiences from the annual Emoja Holiday Market to hands-on maker workshops and live concerts. With a Joy Pass, there will be surprise drops of joy with prizes and treats at participating businesses. 12 Days of Joy and Holiday Magic in Anacostia. Art2Gogo.org for more info.
Inviting all D.C. hand dancers, Philly boppers, Chicago steppers, Carolina shaggers, and West Coast slingers. The Treehouse Dreamers venue offers dance music from Motown and more every Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at 4722 14th Street Northwest. DJ Jam and Dave and other fine DJs provide an atmosphere offering seniors socialization while getting much-needed quality movement through familiar tunes and dance every Friday. Details at 301-922-4064. That's 301-922-4064. WPFW offering wellness through dance, one activity at a time.
Thank you to everyone who supported WPFW on Giving Tuesday. Your generosity helps keep independent, listener-supported radio strong. If you weren't able to give earlier this week, there is always time. Every contribution at any level helps sustain the music, culture, and progressive voices you hear on WPFW every day. Our end-of-year drive begins Sunday, December 14th. For listeners with IRAs, this is also a reminder that year-end required minimum distributions are approaching. A qualified charitable distribution may be a meaningful way to support WPFW while meeting your RMD. However you choose to give, thank you for standing with community, people-powered radio. Please call 202-588-9739 or visit WPFWFM.org to learn more. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to the collision. The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a